Welcome to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. This series is brought to you by the UMass Office of Equity and Inclusion and features members of the university community and other experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. In these episodes, we'll learn about the work and experiences of our guests and gain insight from their expertise. Your host for this podcast is Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Interim Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion, and Professor of Sport Management in the Eisenberg School of Management. And now, here's Neff.
So today we have with us Dr. Whitney Battle Baptiste, historical archaeologist, tenured full professor in the Department of Anthropology, and director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Center. Her research focuses on the intersection of race, gender, class, and sexuality through an archaeological lens. Dr. Baptiste, Thank you for being here with us today. There's a lot going on in the world from every angle possible right now. And to have you take time out of your busy schedule, out of your summer schedule with your family to be here with us, we really appreciate it. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, how are you first? Let's start before we get into it. How are you doing? How are you managing in this COVID changed world?
I have to admit, it's twofold, I think. I think that the pace in which we all have been moving is pretty unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think that in an ironic way, that's why I'm talking about two sides, it's a forced slowdown. It's a moment to kind of reflect. Mm-hmm. Spending time at home, spending time with family. I have never cooked and washed as many dishes and it's been a shift. And just also thinking about how to teach in this moment is also mm-hmm. something that I feel that slowing down has helped me to kind of recoup and be very thoughtful in how I'm gonna move forward. And I haven't had a lot of time to do that because of the constant of our lives and our meetings and all the obligations that we have as tenured Black women faculty at a, you know, an institution like UMass. So that's why I say it's a double-edged sword. So I have slowed down, and it has also helped me to kind of reassess and think more concretely about the kinds of ways I want to reach and how to kind of enhance an online experience, which is going to be a challenge, right?
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's how I'm doing. And
okay.
But on the other side, which I know we're going to get into, it has really been eye-opening in the sense that the internet and information is a touch away. Mm-hmm. The news is on 24-hour cycle. And the idea that all that has happened around anti-Black racism, it's unavoidable to see it. And so yeah. I think that that has also impacted my approaches to what I want to teach in this moment.
Absolutely. You said something that stuck out to me, and I know I'm already going a little bit off script here. But you spoke about being a Black woman faculty member on this campus, on most campuses, probably most predominantly white institutions we're probably speaking to, so big state schools. How has this moment shifted that for you, right? So we know sort of the emotional labor that faculty of color, women of color do in their departments with students, mentoring, typically being one of few. How has that shifted in this moment? I mean, typically this is a quiet time for faculty. We're able to sort of retreat away and do research and work on our course material. But I know I found myself spending a lot more time with students, whether it's text, email, social media, whatever that might be. How has that shifted a little bit for you?
Actually, for me, it's in the way of, I would say, less with students at this moment. Mm-hmm. I at the end of last semester when we transitioned to online, there were a lot of kind of some one-on-one Zooms and just trying to help students figure this out, as well as seniors. Mm-hmm. It was really hard for them to not have that graduation that they had, you know, hoped for. But it was also, there was also an emotional toll, I think, on being home and feeling disconnected from campus and the social aspects of, you know, the life of a 18 to 21 year old, right? Mm-hmm. And, but more recently, I have had a lot of requests for conversations, running book groups, my work on Du Bois, or, you know, my work toward an anti-racist archaeology has been picked up on Twitter. I've had a lot of Twitter activity over the last 2 weeks. Yeah, I had no idea that one sentence could spur such, I've learned what a troll really is, like, personally. But it's a lot of requests for, you know, participation on panels. How do we, what do we, when do we, is this the right, you know, it's a lot of popularity for those of us who are not just Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but also those of us who actually research and have talked about race and racism in our work. I think that, you know, now is the time for us. So that has shifted a lot. I've heard from entities that I would never, you know, not never have thought I would, but I just feel like I'm a little bit more popular right now than I was maybe in March.
Yeah, and I was saying that I've noticed, following you on Twitter, I've noticed sort of the pickup in the things that you say and how people attach themselves to it and retweet it, and it becomes a conversation and sort of it creates its own energy, right, behind the words that you're saying, which is powerful. But I think at the same time, that's work, right? That's work, that's labor, and that's work and labor that, again, as faculty, we're typically not used to in this point of the year. So I want to recognize that. I also appreciate it because I'm learning stuff from you, just like everyone else. So I appreciate you taking that moment in this time right now to use your voice on social media in that way. So back to the script a little bit. You do a lot for our UMass community. I mean, you do a lot. You're a tenured full professor. You're running a very important center. And of course, you conduct research, you write, and you teach. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, how did you end up at UMass? Why did you decide to be an archaeologist? Just your story. Tell us about your story.
I started out in history, and I started out at a historically Black college and Virginia State University. I think the default career was high school teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I went into secondary education. And then the choice was Teach for America, Peace Corps, or graduate school. And I decided on graduate school because I got into the College of William & Mary, and it was a pretty good deal. And it was offering this archaeological internship, which I didn't know what that meant. But when I arrived in Williamsburg, it was quick that I realized that I was going to be a TA. A teaching assistant for an archaeological field school, and I had never excavated in my life, so how could I be a TA? I had about a week. I quickly learned, and I have to admit, it was life-changing and altering for me, because to me, it was for the first time I felt the real and kind of tangible evidence of a past that I was really trying to search for. I wanted to look at kind of the early story of Africans in the US and or in the American colonies. And I wanted to kind of fill in that gap, because I had really focused focused more on kind of contemporary Africa as an undergrad, and archaeology, I got hooked immediately and completely shifted. So I got my master's there and then went on to University of Texas and Decided to go full-fledged anthropologist and became an archaeologist. And I began with plantation archaeology. And my dissertation was on Andrew Jackson's 1,200-acre plantation and focused on the captives that were on his plantation specifically. And I realized that for me, I wanted to tell a story from the perspective of someone who understood that this story was a part of my ancestors' stories. And I did not run into many archaeologists that looked like me. And I understood that a lot of the folks that I was digging with in those early years when I started did not have a background in African-American studies or culture, but anthropology. And I was shocked. I was like, how can you dig on a plantation focused on African-American archaeology and African-American sites, and you don't have this foundation in African-American studies? And so I think from that point, I wanted to do something to kind of shift that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I, UMass was very appealing to me because of the connection with W.E.B. Du Bois, whom before I got here, I really thought I knew who he was. And now that I've been reading him for 14 years, I realized that I didn't know anything about who the real Du Bois was. And through his papers and his archive and just interacting with the amazing scholars that have come through our fellowship program, I'm not an expert. I don't know if anyone could be an expert on someone who lived and for 95 years and probably wrote for about 85. That's a lot to tackle. Mm-hmm. But it was the archaeology of Du Bois' home site in Great Barrington that kind of attracted me to this space. And also brought my timeline a little bit closer to contemporary times and looking at the Du Bois home site, which is at the turn of the century more than, way back in 1860s and 1850s. So Du Bois was the pull to come here. Mm-hmm. And this is an archaeology program that I felt was, that it would be possible to help shift that dialogue that I wanted to do earlier when I realized that so many people didn't know anything about the folks who lived on the sites that they were excavating.
Yeah, wow, that's mm-hmm. that's powerful. And excuse me, as you talk through this, I can see how passionate you are, right? Like how passionate and close you are to the work that you do. How do you keep bringing that energy, you know, every day? You said 14 years of being here and sort of being entrenched in Du Bois. How do you keep bringing that energy to your work and to your research and your writing and even your teaching?
I have to be honest, sometimes it's not easy, mm-hmm. but there's a couple of reasons why I think the energy stays fresh. Recently read a book by a woman named Christina Sharp, and it's called In the Wake. And there's a quote in there that I've been using for the last year or so. I am engaging in a past that is not past. And by saying that, I'm literally talking about the repercussions of the fact that I started out talking about slavery. When I was at William & Mary, I was looking at the impact of owning human beings was more valuable than even land. Because if you had land and no one to cultivate it, it didn't make as much of a difference if you didn't have that human, the labor. And so that was, I did when my master's, I was looking at 18th century, then 19th century at the Hermitage, and then pushing along to 20th century at the Du Bois home site. But what I also noticed is that I am very engaged with what we call in anthropology, African-American expressive culture. And that is a part of archaeology because it's material. It is non-tangible and tangible. It is art, it is music, it is dance, it is folklore, it is literature. And this is something that I feel very, very solid in. And when I teach, I realized when I engage classrooms, very mixed classrooms, that there's so much of what I'm telling them that they've never been exposed to. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, constantly motivates me to help people or help my students not feel guilty about knowing, not knowing these facts or these historical moments, but to open up their minds to the fact that the past that we're learning about can actually be applied to the class I teach on hip hop and mm-hmm. hip hop culture. And so understanding the power of music through time is and something that becomes global and something that is over 50 years old is to me helpful, because when I start my hip hop class out, we're talking about plantation songs mm-hmm. and prison work songs and the blues. And when you put that together, you start to see, oh, that's spoken word, or oh, that's you know, conscious hip hop, or that's, you know, and so it's all of these ways of understanding hip hop as an aspect mm-hmm. of culture that can in many ways be tied to a past that is not past. And that is sometimes very eye-opening, even for the folks that come into my class thinking they know everything about hip hop. Those are my favorite students, because they keep me fresh. And I learn as much from my students, to be honest, than I'm trying to teach them. And that has been something that I'm very grateful that I can recognize. And I know that I don't know it all. And that to me keeps me going, because if I knew it all, then I guess why, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I get that. I get the idea of students encouraging that energy, right? Like sort of feeding off their energy as well in the classroom. And I appreciate that. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the importance of this historical moment that we're living in right now. The protest against anti-Black violence that's been going on now for over a month at least. This anti-racism movement that we're seeing is, you know, everyone's using the language, people are reading the books, there's an energy around that. And I want to talk about that moment and how it may be impacting, influencing your role as director. But also your research and your teaching.
So as I said, you know, along my timeline of mm-hmm. the research keeps moving to more and more contemporary issues. First of all, I want to start with your second point about mm-hmm. the movement in terms of anti-racism as something that is coming to the kind of forefront of many conversations mm-hmm. and I'm a little wary and I'm a little afraid, because I think that we have to be careful of not just thinking in binaries. Either you're racist or you're anti-racist, and that is a problem, because mm-hmm. there is a lot to learn about what anti-racism actually is. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, in some ways, being careful with overusing the word intersectionality, right? That then loses the power of revolution that it once had, you know, when Kimberly Crenshaw first coined the term. And I don't use the word ally anymore. I want comrades or accomplices. And in that means that there is also an aspect of your own privilege and position that you put in danger mm-hmm. by putting yourself out there. And we've seen it a lot in the movements that have happened for Black Lives Matter. And that's good to see, but there are levels to it. And it's just, how does that anti-racism translate to the college campus? I am going to be very observant about how that works and what that looks like, because anti-racism should be happening in the sciences, the hard sciences, and as you know, in business, in in communication, in anthropology. It's not simply reading the books and understanding the languages and what to say and what not to say. Shifting your syllabi, right, to include Black, Indigenous, and all folks of color in what you teach, but also how you position, let's say, for example, how you position your whiteness in the ways in which you engage your students. Mm-hmm. How do you engage your Black, Indigenous, or folks of color in your class room setting? And I know that this is a lot of ways, a lot of the feedback I get from students that say that their classroom experience is a slightly traumatic, dare I say, being kind of focused on because of who they are, or feeling very uncomfortable because if they speak up, their speaking up is perceived in a certain way. So I think that at the core of anti-racism on a campus, there has to be real engagement with faculty. Mm-hmm. And I mean faculty from across the board. Because if you believe, as I learned in my Twitter engagements or exchanges, the belief that science is impartial. There is no race in science. There is no sexism in science. There is no heteronormativity in science. All of these things are, I'm sorry, they're just not true.
Yeah.
But so that's why I wanted to address that first part, because I think that for me, what has happened, and I want to say this has happened probably since about 2013. And it was probably and this is around the same time where Black Lives Matter came together and became a movement, was the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and Michael Brown. I think that grouping and that period of time, and of course Freddie Gray, but more significantly, those three very young men, and myself raising two Black boys who will be Black men, and having a husband and a father and a brother who all are Black men, I was unable to ignore the fear and tried to think in the same ways that I wanted to shift my own, the ways in which people ask questions of archaeology. I want to bring archaeology into the conversation of anti-Black racism. And so the way my work is shifting toward is to literally look at the material aspects of state-sanctioned violence, the militarization of the police, which are physical aspects of shifting the police from being to serve and protect to being law enforcement, and how that shift is seen materially, but has psychological effects on people who are already in many ways suffering from, you know, domestic PTSD.
Yeah.
And that for some is like, well, I don't understand, but it's simple. I can look at hip hop through an archaeological lens in terms of material, in terms of the obsession with consumer culture and material and wealth. Well, I'm sorry, rich, not wealth.
Yeah. Right?
And then I can also really kind of look at, and I'll give you an example to make it a little more concrete, and then I'll end there because I can go on and on.
No, this is good. This is good.
The hoodie for me, I feel different about a hoodie in 2011 than I did after 2012, when Trayvon Martin was murdered. And that seems very subtle, but in a dialogue around anti-racism, even wearing a mask and going to a store, because we're in the midst of COVID, can potentially be not a great thing for, let's say, a Black man, let's say it's raining outside, you have your hoodie on and you have your mask because it's required by the governor, and you walk into a store. The repercussions of the material and the way in which we are perceived is actually our bodies that are feared. Yet, it is blamed on the hoodie, right? The broken taillight, falling asleep in your car, a no-knock warrant. I mean, you know, these are the material and physical things that begin the encounter that don't have to end in death, but the idea of fear, right? The fear of other, but more specifically, the fear of not just Black men, but the fear of Black anger, the fear of the embodiment of threat has, it is something that I've been trying to write about before the death of George Floyd. And I have to admit, it has been very hard to write about it as you see it going on. And to read, it's a very emotionally and psychologically difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
But I really want to push. I really, really want to push folks to understand that anti-racism is not easy either. And that's why I started with my fear that anti-racism will just be seen as, in some ways, a trope, and not actually a way that you have to change your life. So
that was a lot, but that was excellent. That was heavy, right? I mean, you spoke the piece that you spoke about the repercussions of the material and thinking about the hoodie, right? So I'm a former college athlete. I live in sweats. So living in South Hadley, being a faculty member, being an administrator at UMass, I still think twice when I'm going for a run or I'm going to walk my dog with a hoodie on, right? Especially if it's 7 to 8 o'clock at night, if it's dawn or dusk, and I like to put my hoodie actually on, right? So I'm now walking in the morning by myself in the middle of South Hadley with a Black hoodie on and Black tights and a Black dog, right? And these are things that I'm constantly negotiating and navigating. So, you know, I think that really resonated with me, everything that you said and thinking about it in that particular type of way. So I love, absolutely adore this research that you're doing currently. So thank you for that.
And living in South Hadley as well, I think about Amon Aubrey and I think about what it is to be a Black man jogging. Mm-hmm. In your neighborhood, like that, these are the kinds of, and for example, actually my husband was pulled over recently and everything was fine, but I believe he didn't put his sticker on his tag, which he never does. So he drives around with it, which is, doesn't work. But, and the police officer, as they were in conversation, the police officer actually had a trainee with him, and it began to be a whole conversation because my husband tends to be befriend almost anyone he meets. But there was a white woman that actually pulled over and took out her cell phone and filmed the entire thing. And he said that was the first time that he has physically ever seen that happen to him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, what did the police officer do? The police officer said to him, there's a woman over there and she's taping on her cell phone. I just need you to know. And he's like, okay, well, that's fine. I'm glad she's doing that. But that's a different moment. A different moment when people realize that something that seems so innocent, such as Rayshawn Brooks, you can be talking to a police officer and somehow something happens and it all goes awry. Yeah. And I think that the ability to not be able to look away for me is extremely important. And I'm still trying to figure out how we convey this on a college campus. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's, I mean, certainly, you know, our Office of Equity and Inclusion, that's something that we're constantly navigating. I mean, every single day we're talking about that very thing, right? Because like you said, anti-racism isn't easy. I mean, it's not easy. And what we talk about most is that it's super duper messy. It's very messy. And every way that you think about it, it's not just reading a book and then applying it. It's much messier than that. So I appreciate you sharing that story as well, because I think something that you said about the ordinary, right? It just, you know, getting pulled over because of your tags, no big deal. That's ordinary. But in this moment in time, we've recognized that when it comes to Black lives, it absolutely is not ordinary. Something that routine can turn into death. And that's how serious it is for Black lives in this country. So I appreciate you sharing that story. So we're going to shift gears again. Your course that you're teaching this fall, I saw you tweet it. I think I got an email about it and I was like, this course is dope. I wish I could take it, but I can't because I'm supposed to be working. So we're going to get the professor in here to tell us about this course. So it's entitled Du Bois in Our Time. It's in anthropology. I forget the number, but tell us a little bit about this course, please.
Okay, it's a very ambitious course. it's because the subtitle is technically From Black Reconstruction to Black Lives Matter, which would mean that I'm talking about from like 1867 to 2020. I don't know, but. Or maybe if I cut it off at the beginning, maybe 2015. But it's Anthro 297W.
Okay.
It's in the process of becoming a regular course. It's the second time I'm teaching it. What I'm trying to do is introduce the work of Du Bois, who, although wrote many, many years ago, so much of what he wrote about is extremely relevant today. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm doing is introducing the work of Du Bois and actually coupling it with contemporary representations of, mm-hmm. of similar events, similar issues, et cetera. And for example, we talk about, we start out with kind of the first couple of chapters of Black Reconstruction, which is an extremely large book. It is over 900 pages, mm-hmm. so we do not read the whole book, so don't worry. But what we also do is actually read the Emancipation Proclamation, because so many students have never actually read the words.
Yeah.
We read the Bill of Rights, which is not something that we read and kind of tap into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And we hear about Second Amendment rights. We hear about the 13th Amendment. We hear about the 14th Amendment. But as we're reading that, we're also reading excerpts of Du Bois's take on what happened when those were being argued in Congress and the Senate. And what's interesting is that when the first time I taught it is when the impeachment trial for Donald Trump was going on, and the arguments that we were reading about, the quotes that we were reading about, several students were like, this is what's happening right now. Like, yeah. They're arguing about someone being a human,
yeah.
meaning not just being, you know, because in the Constitution, you know, folks of African descent are clearly 3/5 of a human being in order to get the proper representation. But what that translates into is we had to be made whole, mm-hmm. but then we had to be given our citizenship, and then we had to be given the right to vote. So it kept going on, and the students, when they read this, and we read it together, and when they read this, it sparked, I thought, to be honest, I thought they were going to be bored and this, but when they read Du Bois's take on when captive folks first became free, thinking about all of those millions of people that were now looking for work.
Yeah.
What did that mean about competition? How did that mean about immigration? they never thought about it like that. So we were looking at a moment during that Reconstruction period that the United States could have gone in the way of a labor movement.
Yeah.
But something got in the way, and it's called race. And so as we break that down, that's how we start the conversation. And we tapped a little bit into the 1619 project, which ranges from the arrival of Africans to the prison industrial complex.
Yeah.
And we, amazingly, a couple of my students found a website that there is a prison, I want to say it's in Louisiana, that has a golf course on the prison. Like, you can shoot 9 holes, and in the background is the prison. And
wow.
The golf course is not for the prisoners. The golf course is for people that are joining this country club.
Wow.
And it was nuances like that. And so what happened is every week students started to bring in the things in contemporary moments that reminded them of the discussions we were having. And so it was a historical class, but it was a class about our nation. It was a class about, why are Black people so mad?
Yeah.
Why are we constantly, you know, screaming about anti-Blackness? And what is anti-Blackness?
Mm-hmm.
What is white privilege? What is anti-racism? So we do get into a lot of that, from politics to literature, and talking about poetry as well. Du Bois wrote poetry, and we get into a little bit about state-sanctioned violence, and Du Bois wrote about police violence as well, as early as kind of, I think it was around in the 19-teens when he was at Atlanta University. He gave a survey to his class about their interactions with police.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating how when you read that, it's a little scary because it sounds like it's someone today.
Yeah, so similar to what's happening now.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the class is, and again, it might shift a little bit because we've shifted since the last time I taught it, and now it's online. So I might have the opportunity to kind of, show some more media and show some more things that keep you interested and excited. I don't know.
So. Yeah, no, that sounds fantastic. I especially loved the part where you're talking about the students in the readings and then going out in the real world and finding examples of how the same things that they're reading about from 100 years ago are still manifesting in society today, right? And that realization that, you know, especially for certain students that don't have to see racism every day, right? To see why people are so angry and to see the fact that we haven't overcome racism and that it's so deeply entrenched in, you know, just about every part of our society, I bet was absolutely eye-opening. Yeah. So. Yeah,
and we do actually talk about whiteness.
Yeah.
We talk about why whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
What is the myth of whiteness?
Mm-hmm.
What does that give you?
Yeah.
Actually, next Wednesday, I'll be talking on the series with UMass Athletics on race. And I'll be talking to coaches and staff and trying to have uncomfortable conversations. So it's a lot of work. It is a lot of labor, but I'm going to be honest. I feel very strongly about supporting people who want to do the work.
Yeah.
And do it in a way that's not just fly by night, but actually concretely going to keep you uncomfortable for a while,
mm-hmm.
if not forever.
Yeah. So there's a lot of anxiety, right? Just in society, there's anxiety amongst our UMass community in response to coronavirus and anti-Black racism and anti-Black violence and the protest. And we have, you know, xenophobia and anti-Asian racism and on and on and on, right? We can go on with sort of this moment in time that's filled with so much tension that we're living in. Do you have any advice for people that are seemingly new to this conversation, right? So folks that are having their awakening in this moment and trying to become, you know, I don't think you become anti-racist. I think you live in that spirit and that energy of anti-racism. But nonetheless, do you have any advice for these folks?
I think, and here is something that when I talk about it, especially with Black students, they kind of give me a strange look. The power of anti-Black racism is that you don't have to be white to participate or uphold it. Mm-hmm. You can also be Black and be and act in anti-Black ways against mm-hmm. yourself, against your community, against others, etc. I think for me, initially, I try to talk, I know this sounds a little bit, I don't use one of these corny, I don't think people understand that word anymore.
But I still understand what corny means.
Okay, thank you. I'm talking to you. So I think that to try to look for a way, instead of you not understanding, to try to figure out how, because the word that keeps coming in my mind is empathy. Mm-hmm. And empathy in the way that is real and constructive, not mm-hmm. pity, not to understand that when one maps out all of the ways in which race plays into educational disparities, health disparities, income disparities, and you can go on and on, not to see that as a way to, for someone that has experienced one or many of those, to blame, mm-hmm. but to understand that institutional and systemic racism and injustice is not something that is easily undone. Mm-hmm. And even by participating in certain things, in certain programs, in certain organizations, are you contributing to upholding that systemic, those systemic disparities? And I think that questioning who you are and how you can shift, to me, is a very difficult question, because I try to convey to people, it takes small steps, but the small steps have to lead to bigger steps. Mm-hmm. So when I have a faculty of color that is junior and is asking me, how can I do this work and how can I do community research and still get tenure mm-hmm. and not find the repercussions of me doing, you know, in anthropology, we get accused of studying our own. Mm-hmm. My answer to that is, I'm a full professor. If I don't push the envelope, if I don't use my position to say I am on the college personnel committee, mm-hmm. the way in which this person's research is conducted has to be translated so that everyone can understand that mm-hmm. what this professor is doing is not just groundbreaking, it is contributing to her field or yeah. to her discipline or to whatever. It means that if you're in that position of power, you use that position of power to, even if it's not a tectonic shift, right?
Yeah.
But to slowly shift that to a place where research that matters to the students that we have now and the students that we have coming in the future mm-hmm. can not only relate to, but can dive right into and learn
yeah.
and grow. It's about a constructive way to use those small steps to take bigger steps, but also to take your position of power
yeah.
and use that power to help those that need that translation sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example, but that's something that I feel very strongly about, because if I'm in this position, because people took a chance and made sure that the work that I was doing was translatable to the academy
yeah.
in a way that I am blessed, because I have not compromised what I've done and I've never compromised my tongue, which is a good thing, I guess, but I know I make you know, some people uncomfortable, but I think the irony is those people that I have made uncomfortable in the past might think back to some of the things that I may have said and say, maybe she had a point.
Yeah.
And come into conversation again. And so for me, it's being a full professor that I don't take lightly, and I don't dismiss it, and mm-hmm. I don't say, oh, no, don't do that, don't, yeah. Well, I do sometimes with my friends, as you know, but I do want to encourage, especially students, I let them know. Yeah. I am a full professor, there's not many of us that look like me, and understand that I'm still teaching you what I know, what I think you need to learn.
Yeah.
And so I think it's the small steps that go into the medium steps that go into taking chances,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think that power is very important and very significant for us to move the system that does not want to budge. And I think that is one of the ways, again, you have empathy and you understand and use your power for constructive change and not necessarily the status quo.
Thank you. I had a few words that I was going to say, but after that ending, that's solid. I so appreciate you. We so appreciate you as, you know, an Office of Equity and Inclusion for taking this time. I mean, there's so many powerful pieces of information, so many powerful gems that you've left us in this conversation that I know people will absolutely get a lot of sort of affirmation from and understanding from. So thank you so much for your time.
So much for inviting me, and I am here for OEI and the campus community, because the Du Bois Center is here, and there's a lot of work to do.
All right.